From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And in Charlottesville today, a memorial service for 32-year-old Heather Heyer, killed over the weekend when a car plowed into people who've been protesting a rally of hate groups. Here's Heyer's father, Mark, speaking at the memorial.
She loved people. She wanted equality. And in this issue of the day of her passing, she wanted to put down hate. And for my part, we just need to stop all this stuff and just forgive each other.
Well, meanwhile, the spasm of reaction to President Trump's extraordinary off-the-cuff press conference yesterday continues. The president reverted to his original assessment of what happened in Charlottesville, saying that the alt-left came charging at the alt-right, that there were innocents protesting the taking down of a Confederate statue, which he seemed to say should not come down. Domenico Montanaro, lead politics editor for NPR, joins us in the studio here in Washington. Domenico, talk about some of the reaction.
Well, look, you've had Republican leaders break with this president in ways that we haven't seen throughout even the campaign with everything that Donald Trump had said. So that's really saying something, that this has seemed to resonate with them even more strongly than almost anything else Trump has done.
Well, the sound has been out all day. We'll link it at hereandnow.org. But here's a little bit of what President Trump had to say responding to press questions.
And you had some very bad people in that group, but you also had people that were very fine people on both sides. You had people in that group. Excuse me. I saw the same pictures as you did. You had people in that group that were there to protest the taking down of, to them, a very, very important statue.
Domenico, we have spoken to reporters who were there. They say they did not see people other than the white supremacists and Nazis who were rallied here for this moment. Fine people on both sides.
Look, this is a very big moment for the American presidency, for the American public, in how Americans decide to respond is a big part of this. You know, Americans generally in times of tragedy and difficulty look to their presidents for leadership to try to heal and to try to unify. Abraham Lincoln, in his first inaugural address before the Civil War began, said that he hopes at the end that the better angels of our nature can be appealed to. For Americans this morning, waking up after those remarks, it seems that they have to look to themselves.
Yeah. Both Presidents Bush have released statements saying that there is no place for bigotry in this country. Lindsey Graham pretty much said to the president, you are dividing us. But this extraordinary press conference, by the way, we heard a little bit of that. The president seemed to go on to say, at one point he said, well, what's next? Are we going to take down statues of President Washington? He seemed to be agreeing with the neo-Nazis and white supremacists who were rallying to stop this statue from being taken down. This was supposed to be a conference about infrastructure, and he kept saying, aren't you going to ask me about infrastructure? Is there any way reporters, when speaking to him, can go to any issues like infrastructure or North Korea or healthcare when this is on the table?
Well, not when he makes these kinds of controversial remarks. And we've seen him do this throughout the campaign and throughout his presidency, where something is supposed to be about one thing and then inevitably becomes about something else. And particularly on race. Race is the original sin in American life. So any time a president decides to lean into that and do it in a way that President Trump did, it's going to get attention and overshadow anything else.
Well, we're talking about anti-Semitism as well. Vice TV had a reporter embedded, and we're going to be hearing more of the video that they made. But in that video, they talked to one of those white supremacists who calls on President Trump for allowing a Jew to marry his beautiful daughter. These are chilling words.
Right. And you heard them say, you will not replace us. You heard them say, Jews will not replace us. These are clearly intertwined, race and anti-Semitism. The president trying to draw a moral equivalency between those who responded to hate and those who are actually inciting hate are two very different things.
Yeah. Look, the president has tried to change the subject. This morning he tweeted out about North Korea, which, as we talked about yesterday, says that it's backing down from its threats to attack Guam. We talked yesterday about how there's been a lot of behind-the-scenes working to tamp down the president's language of there would be fury and fire, and some thought that that and bringing China into the fold is what got North Korea to back down. But the president, can the president point to his language and say it was his language the fire and fury threat that got them to back down.
The president can try to point to that. And, you know, there are a lot of people who before all of this sort of emerged on Twitter today, who said that maybe his approach was the correct one because nothing else had worked in the past. Yeah. So certainly it looks like Kim Jong-un has backed down somewhat.
NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, before the events in Charlottesville, President Trump made some news on the opioid epidemic, saying last week that he intends to declare a national public health emergency in response to the rising death toll from opioids. It's a step that a handful of states have already taken, including Arizona. Will Stone from Here and Now contributor KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
Steve still has trouble making sense of his slide into addiction, how the occasional pill turned into 5-10 a day.
The fact that it did is still kind of blindsiding just because I honestly, like I drank seldom as a teenager, but never really did anything else.
It began toward the end of college for the now 26-year-old. We're not using his real name because he's worried about losing his job. His partner had a spinal condition and would share his painkillers. When they ran out, they'd look elsewhere.
We were going through a lot, and so just trying to sustain that was very tough.
That lasted for years, Steve says, losing friends, lying to each other.
We didn't have anything. You know, we had taken out title loans on our cars, and we had no credit, we had no money.
Steve's story has become all too familiar as the opioid crisis has turned into a public health threat.
It's a problem that knows no bounds. It affects men and women, young and old, rich and poor.
That's Arizona Governor Doug Ducey during his most recent State of the State address. The true extent of Arizona's crisis became painfully clear months later when the state released new numbers showing nearly 800 people died from overdoses in 2016, almost twice the number as in 2012. So the governor declared a public health emergency, a strategy that begins with tracking who's dying and where and how.
Our opioid death data can lag a year behind.
Dr. Kara Chris directs the Arizona Department of Health Services. She's circling a crowded room filled with data specialists, poring over maps and charts.
What we're trying to do is reframe this from an addiction stigma, they're dead, we can move on, to a this is a health condition and it needs to be dealt with just like every other public health issue.
Unlike an infectious disease outbreak, the state's healthcare system is not well equipped to track opioid deaths in real time. A recent University of Virginia study found Arizona has been significantly underreporting overdose deaths. The new declaration requires providers to report overdoses and deaths immediately to the state. In the first 6 weeks, the state puts the death toll at more than 200. Once they get enough data, Chris says the department can fashion a comprehensive response. But she admits this opioid crisis is different from others.
Things that, you know, you rapidly respond to, you can control, and then it comes to an end. The opioid epidemic is something that we've been dealing with for a long time.
Just ask her predecessor, Will Humble. It was during his early days as director of health services. Humble was on the elevator chatting with the guy who ran statistics when he mentioned.
He said, oh, yeah, we ran the statistics and it was really, we were surprised to see that more people in Arizona died from opiate overdoses than from car crashes. I mean, this is back in 2010.
Humble, who now leads the Arizona Public Health Association, says that's when it hit him. He had the agency put together guidelines for physicians when prescribing opioids, but most people weren't paying attention.
You know, it was like we were shouting into the wind and we weren't, you know, it just didn't capture the attention of policymakers and elected officials.
That's finally changing, but there's still no extra funding tied to the crisis, although Arizona does have several federal grants. Humble says that's not necessarily the point of this declaration. Instead,
focusing those areas in state government that have leverage to mobilize their policy, not necessarily funding, but change their policy around opiate prescribing.
He says one example is the governor's directive to Arizona's Medicaid program, limiting the first prescription to 7 days. And Humble expects other efforts to come later and may require new laws and more money. But at least the declaration creates a sense of urgency.
I'd even go one step further, and I'd say that that might be the major benefit, actually.
Dr. Michael Barnett teaches at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Massachusetts was the first state to declare a public health emergency because of the epidemic. Since then, others have followed. Mostly, this has meant increasing access to the opioid reversal drug naloxone and getting more data. And that's a start, Barnett says. After all, this isn't something you can just contain like other emergencies.
There's a much more limited capacity for, you know, extreme government intervention to necessarily make a difference here.
But it does chip away at one of the most intractable problems, stigma, as Steve, who's now in recovery, remembers.
I always thought, you know, addicts are just terrible people who make terrible decisions, who just aren't strong enough. Being through it, like, yeah, it's different. It's totally different, so...
And so is his life now. He's got a car and a job. But as overdoses skyrocket, Steve's story may still be a rare one. For Here and Now, I'm Will Stone in Phoenix.
As we continue to follow the latest news about Charlottesville and the president's comments on the subject, we want to look back now at the history of white supremacist activity in the U.S. We're joined by Nathan Connolly and Ed Ayers, both history professors and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Ed, let me start with you. We could have a whole conversation about slavery, but let's talk today about what happened afterwards. When was the first surge in white supremacist activity in the U.S.?
Well, it begins right after the Civil War. The Ku Klux Klan is born basically in the smoking rubble of the Confederacy. The idea is that there is lawlessness and that white men are going to restore law, by which they mean complete unchallenged white supremacy. But that is then crushed during Reconstruction and fades away in the 1880s and 1890s, but makes a surging comeback, as unlikely as it seems, triggered by a movie, Birth of a Nation, in 1915. And they go to Stone Mountain in Atlanta and burn a cross and rebirth the Ku Klux Klan.
And then I guess the next wave would have been in the 50s, and this is the one that a lot of our listeners may have actually remembered and lived through.
So after the Supreme Court decision in Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954 and then implementation in 55, you begin to see a push for really overt racial desegregation in America. And that leads to a moment that many know as the era of massive resistance. And massive resistance is kind of a crossroads in that you have earlier articulations of Klan and kind of pro-Confederate imagery matched with a much more genteel kind of shirt and tie kind of racism that is invested in property rights and school boundaries and kind of the technical stuff of urban politics.
You know, it's interesting to think that Virginia was the leading state that followed this kind of genteel resistance. And Charlottesville was one of the cities in Virginia that shut down its schools rather than integrate them. So there is this tension that we saw this last weekend has been sort of reverberating here for a long time.
As you know, President Trump has been criticized for his initial silence on what was happening in Charlottesville, and he didn't specifically call out white supremacists when he first made comments to the public. How have past presidents responded to the KKK and other expressions of white supremacy?
There's always been a kind of tension between these high national offices and these hate groups, right? And it's never really been the case that American presidents have been able to fully embrace them for all kinds of reasons, including their willingness to act extra legally and including some of their more overt public statements that many consider rightfully, I suppose, to be anti-democratic. I think it's also important to bear in mind, though, that many politicians became very good at knowing how to offer a kind of wink and a nod to members of the electorate that might have believed themselves to be more in line with some of these white supremacist groups, right? So just as one concrete example, President Ronald Reagan, in the launching of his campaign in the early 1980s, really late 1970s, began campaigning at the Neshoba County Fairgrounds. And Neshoba County was famously the site where Freedom Summer activists were killed in the mid-1960s. And Reagan knew that he could reach into the South and kind of mobilize white working class sentiment there by basically saying that he was in favor of states' rights with that kind of launching. Again, famously in the late 1980s and early 90s, Republican Party politics were also, again, dog whistling on race, sometimes winking and nodding to overt racial groups, but never really stepping into a formal acceptance or even, you know, soft condemnation of those groups. Most statements from the White House tended to at least be condemning of Klan and neo-Nazi chapters, if not necessarily other kinds of white nationalism.
So what we're seeing from President Trump right now is very different, is what you're saying, from what we've seen from presidents in the past in terms of how they're dealing with these groups.
It certainly seems so to me, that there have been sort of a steady decline. And obviously, during the Obama years, the pivot is remarkable, how quickly this new kind of language and signaling seems to be.
The thing about Trump's speech as well is, I mean, he took a lot of heat for his remark about things being kind of violent or volatile on many sides, the on many sides phrase. In that remark alone, there was a lot that was similar to earlier presidential utterances that tended to believe that, you know, black nationalism and white nationalism were, for instance, equally out of bounds, that anybody who was part of the radical left, that was, as it was perceived to be, was just as dangerous as people perceived to be on the radical right. So even in a moment where it was clear that the kind of outrage was one-sided, Trump's use of somewhat equivocal language seemed to put him out of bounds.
One of the other aspects of what we're seeing right now is anti-Semitism. Take us back to some of the history of that in the U.S. and how it got merged in with this white supremacist movement as well.
You know, we've been talking about sort of the tangled roots of the manifestations of white supremacy that we saw in Charlottesville. Here's a case where the roots are deeply entangled on both sides. The Ku Klux Klan identified Jews and Catholics as enemies of the nation. In the 1920s, you would have seen anti-Catholicism being as prominently featured in some places as anti-African-American language. But anti-Semitism has been sort of a steady beat through all this. And obviously, the neo-Nazis were picking up on the themes coming out of Germany. So I'd see the recent events as a convergence of two traditions. What do you think, Nathan?
Yeah, absolutely. The kind of taint of anti-Semitism was really bound to, at many turns, an anti-immigrant sentiment, an anti-black sentiment. And, you know, it's not unlikely or not surprising, I should say, to see now this very strange collapsing that Ed is pointing to, where you have Klan imagery, which is from an earlier period, neo-Nazi imagery, which is from a later period, basically becoming part of this mashup of white nationalist symbolism in a place like Charlottesville. There's also, though, a fourth tradition that people tend to forget about, which is that of the old White Citizens Council, right? Those are the elite whites who in the South didn't really don hoods, but they were much more concerned with low taxes and property rights, and they used a kind of genteel political form in order to keep African Americans in confined spaces. And that politic, too, I would argue, is on display in a place like Charlottesville, you know, where you had a number of people who were very elite and well-educated who were part of this overt demonstration of white nationalism.
Also on display in Charlottesville is something that has caused a lot of angst across the South, which is a statue that is a memorial to the Confederacy. And I wonder, first of all, why there are so many of these statues across the South still today, and have they always been so controversial?
The statues that we see today largely grew up between 1890 and 1920. That was the heyday, and it was also the heyday of statue building in the North as well, partly because veterans are dying and people want to memorialize them. But it was also the time when the South, firmly in control of the voting system, out of segregation, is free to put up monuments to whatever it wants to, and it puts up monuments to what it considers the glorious lost cause of the Confederacy, in which it's called the lost cause because they were up against such large odds, they said. They could not have won, so they must have been fighting for some high ideal. And so the statue in Charlottesville is actually a little bit out of the ordinary. It's put up in 1924 after being commissioned in 1917. But across the South, you would see these statues that have basically been put up 35, 40, even 50 years after the Civil War to kind of stake out the territory as being under the control of the former Confederates.
And when did they become so controversial and people wanted to rip them down?
That's actually quite recently, in the sense of being publicly controversial. They've always been seen as symbols of white supremacy by African Americans. And you can go back and look at the quotations in the newspapers mm-hmm. when, say, that they were first put up. And the editorials say, we know what these are, and we think it's a travesty to be using public land and public monies to put these up. But I don't know, Nathan. It seems to me that what we're seeing now with the great turn against the statues is in some ways a distillate of the controversies over the Confederate flag that sort of reached their peak with the Dillon Roof shooting.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no question that a lot changed once the presidency was desegregated with the election of Barack Obama. And there was a backlash, and there was similarly a kind of recognition that you needed to start reinterpreting the public iconography about the country's heritage. So in the case of someone like Dillon Roof, a lone gunman with a patch about a Confederate flag, that began to raise all kinds of new questions. That, again, old questions, but also new questions about right. whether or not the Confederate flag should be on the grounds of the State House in South Carolina. And certainly around the other kinds of images of the old Confederacy, particularly the statues, but other kinds of historical landmarks. I mean, there's always a question about the meaning of public history. And that's one of the things that I think is really powerful about this moment now and what the country is basically invested in is that you had in Charlottesville over the weekend, you know, in spite of how you may have felt about the demonstration and the torches and the other kinds of, you know, mashup of symbols, that was a moment of public history, right? The people in the street were making an argument about the country's heritage in some kind of way. In response, people are now taking down more Confederate statues in places like Durham, North Carolina and elsewhere, right? I mean, this is a conversation that's happening in bronze and marble and tiki torches right now. It's going to require a lot of really tough work in having discussions about the meaning of the country and the meaning of these symbols and its history in wide public open forums.
Well, that's why it's good that we have you guys here to help us bring the history to what's going on today. Nathan Connolly and Ed Ayers, history professors and hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Early this morning, the city of Baltimore decided to deal with its Confederate monuments directly, but it did not tell anyone in advance. With only a few onlookers standing by, work crews used a large crane to lift four controversial statues off their bases and load them onto a flatbed truck. Mary Rose Madden is a reporter with WYPR in Baltimore and joins us. Mary Rose, welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
And the city council voted on this question of removing the statues on Monday night. Tell us more about how this all went down.
So Mayor Catherine Pugh had been talking about, you know, removing these statues and how she needed to get the right plan in place and the money she needed to gather up. And then Monday afternoon, Councilman Brandon Scott put forward a statement that said, these statues need to go this week. They need to be gone. And then Monday night they voted in support of that. And I don't think anyone expected them to be gone this quickly. Last night when we went to bed, local activist groups were tweeting at the hashtag Do It Like Durham. They were planning to take down the statues themselves this evening. But, you know, the mayor beat them to it. And this morning they were gone.
And the figures in these four monuments, what were they?
The four monuments that were taken down, there was a monument to Generals Robert E. Lee and Thomas Stonewall Jackson. There was a monument to the Supreme Court Chief Justice Roger Taney. And there were two other monuments. One monument was the Confederate Soldiers and Sailors Monument, and the other was the Confederate Women's Monument. All four were taken down.
So were people out? Did they figure out quickly that this was going on and show up to support it or to object to it last night?
The mayor didn't tell everyone that this was happening. So some of us woke up this morning surprised, including Larry Wallace. Larry Wallace was at the place where once stood the Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson Monument. He was there with his daughter, his 7-year-old daughter, and he was one of many who were taking photos, snapping pictures of themselves and their kids in front of the pedestals.
And I believe it was removed because they don't want the same thing happen here in Baltimore City like it happened down in Virginia. I'm glad that peace was here.
So Larry Wallace was one of about 40 folks who were there. The scene this morning was, people were chatting. The pedestal has spray-painted Black Lives Matter. Are we helping smash white supremacy? There's signs that read white supremacy is terrorism. And there's also a local artist has put up a sculpture of an African-American woman with a baby on her back, her fist held high, sort of as a sign of power, defiance. This sculpture is probably about 10 feet high. And so a lot of people were talking about what that sculpture meant and the significance and the symbolism this morning of what happened.
What will happen to the statues now?
So it's reported that the mayor had them carted off to the county, and they may be deposited in cemeteries around the state that do pay homage to Confederate soldiers.
That's Mary Rose Madden, a reporter with WYPR in Baltimore. Mary Rose, thanks.
You're welcome.
And clear across the country in Los Angeles, news today that the Hollywood Forever Cemetery removed a monument there commemorating Confederate veterans. The LA Times reports that the monument will be put in storage, but the grave markers for more than 30 Confederate veterans and their families will remain.
The world is teeming with artificial intelligence. Just last week, we did a story about farmers using robots to milk their cows. An umpire robot has called balls and strikes at a baseball game. There are pharmacist robots, robot fashion models, but a robot journalist? Wait a minute. Here now is Peter O'Dowd, found one, and it got him thinking about his future.
From Dallas, Texas, the Flash, apparently official.
On November 22, 1963, Walter Cronkite told the most human of stories.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
The information in that CBS newscast was deceptively simple. Where? Dallas, Texas. Who? President Kennedy. When? 38 minutes ago. Cronkite removed his dark-framed glasses. He paused, then continued reading. Anyone watching could tell the most trusted man in America was moved by the news. How in the world could a robot handle that assignment? Well, here's how, someday, one might.
We call it heliograph.
At the headquarters of the Washington Post, a journalist named Jeremy Gilbert is using artificial intelligence to write the news. Consider him the robot reporter's editor. Heliograph doesn't parachute into the latest disaster or shout questions at a White House press briefing. This reporter works inside a machine.
Heliograph is really just a set of algorithms that take data coming in and write stories going out.
Can you show me Heliograph here on the computer? What does Heliograph look like?
Well, so Heliograph looks a lot more like algebra than anything else.
Gilbert shows me the computer code that the Post data science team has written. It's a template that gives Heliograph a set of rules. Like a fancy version of the word game Mad Libs, the scaffolding has already been built. Plug in the who, the what, the where, and the computer does the rest. Heliograph's first day on the job was last summer alongside human reporters at the Rio Olympics.
We wanted to make sure that our journalists weren't watching TV and writing down what happened on the screen. It's not a great use of human resources. And yet, we had historically always written down what was the outcome of every event as fast as we possibly could. And so Heliograph was a great solution for that because it can take a data feed from the IOC via stats.com, and then it can publish stories off of that. So it can say who won, it can say which country had the most medals, it can say how fast or how many points or by what margin was the winner the winner. Those were about as basic a story as it could be. I mean, in many ways, it was more like the answer to a question your friend might ask you than the traditional coverage of a sporting event.
3 months later, by election night in America, Heliograph had already upped its game. The robot used polling data to write and update in real time nearly 500 Washington Post stories, including this one from Nevada.
So in this particular case, it says Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto has beaten Joseph J. Heck, a Republican, in the race for Nevada's Senate seat currently held by Harry Reid. The Republicans kept control of the Senate majority, fending off what was thought to be a strong takeover bid by the Democrats.
Let me reemphasize, a robot wrote that.
And then it starts to go into, well, how did the other Senate races fare?
Can I ask you to use your journalist and editor smarts here to judge how the robot did writing that news story? It looks pretty good.
I would say it's at least a B+. The facts are all right. That said, is this a story I would have said I would send a Washington Post reporter out to cover just this? No, it wouldn't be worth it. On the other hand, if we can have Washington Post reporters and editors work in advance of the election, figure out a smart set system of templates, and then use that system to cover an event like this, then sure, I think this story has value for people, especially people living in Nevada.
Are we going to see a day when Heliograph or another type of robot is making phone calls to sources, sending emails to sources, I don't know, getting quotes?
I think quotes are possible. I think we're less likely to play a telephone game than we are to reach out to people on social media or maybe send emails and see what comes of that. Say it's a sporting event. Could we ask the coach why they made the decision they did? Sure. That seems doable.
So you're saying a robot could take a news story like a team winning a game and query the coach afterwards?
Absolutely. Looking at the play-by-play data and saying this was a turning point in the game. We can understand that mathematically. Why did you decide to do what you did there? Those are the same kinds of questions a human sports writer would ask.
Which means that human sports writer better start asking questions about her future. Other news organizations like the Associated Press and Reuters are using algorithms to generate news content. Gilbert says human reporters are not about to lose their jobs. The Post newsroom has added 140 new journalists since 2013.
I don't believe that algorithmic reporting like Heliograph will replace human reporters or should. We're not taking jobs that people in the newsroom want to have. Instead, we're looking at work that would go undone and trying to do it anyway.
Isn't it easy to say now that it's not going to take a journalist's job? But we don't really know. We're in the early days of this.
I mean, certainly there are jobs today that don't exist in our newsroom that were there 25 years ago. There were people who were involved in the paste-up process. There were all kinds of people who did everything from take dictation on the phone, which we don't need because we can email. I think the jobs will evolve. I don't anticipate at the Washington Post that algorithmic storytelling will ever replace human storytelling. I think it'll augment it. I think it'll complement it. But I don't see it replacing it because I think if our humans are doing those kinds of stories, we're doing the wrong stories. Eli Saslow, who is a brilliant feature writer for us, we are not going to train an algorithm to go and befriend subjects and spend months with them and think deeply about what kind of a scene we can paint. So those kinds of stories, they take too much creativity.
And maybe he's right. Maybe creativity and a human touch will keep robots from taking over the newsroom. But maybe he's wrong.
There are already algorithms that can write original symphonies, for example, paint original works of art.
Futurist Martin Ford wrote a book called Rise of the Robots. In it, he cites the work of Imus, a computer that wrote this music on its own.
So there are already examples of what we would have to acknowledge is computer creativity. There is no end point to this. There's no point at which you say, well, artificial intelligence is going to get this good and it's never going to go beyond this. It's just going to continue to get better and better. And one of the areas that it's going to push into is certainly creativity, as well as this more emotional ability to interact with human beings. They're both very much on the table in terms of what can happen in the future.
Wow. Yeah, but I have a voice.
Right. Well, computers have voices too, and they're getting better and better at sounding very, very human.
Amazon Prime's $5 at 99 cents monthly discount has industry experts puzzled, but the company's newest strategy is one to take notes on.
That Prime was the voice of a robot reporter.
This is Zohar.
Created by Zohar Dayan, the co-founder of a company called Wibbits.
Essentially, we've created a technology that works the same way that a human video producer works when he approaches a story.
The Wibbits robot starts with an article from a client like Reuters. It goes looking through its database then to stitch together related video and pictures. In this case, maybe it's images from an Amazon factory floor. Then it builds a news story with a voiceover like the one you just heard.
Something like a Siri voice or an Amazon Echo voice.
Yeah. You know it's a robot.
You can understand it's a robot. These technologies are getting very good with time. So we think that it's going to become much more human-like. There are very interesting technologies out there in terms of voice copying. So you can actually have a famous news anchor and kind of mimic his voice through the automatic engine.
I've heard of this company. It's the one out of Montreal.
Yes.
That company is called Lyrebird. Examples of their work are online. Its algorithm just needs a sample of a human voice, like the 44th president's.
Hey, Doc, have you heard about this new technology?
Or the 45th's.
Are you speaking about this new algorithm to copy voices?
Before it can make those voices say completely novel sentences.
Yes, it is developed by a startup called Lyrebird.
This is huge. It can make us say anything now, really anything.
Yes, Mr. President, this is huge. Clearly, a lot of work still needs to be done, and robots still aren't very good at explaining the why of a big story. But someday, a robot probably could do my job and even sound like me while doing it. Makes you wonder what Walter Cronkite would say about that.
And that's the way it is.
Wednesday, August 16th, I'm a human being named Peter O'Dowd.
You're listening to Here and Now.
There's a big change coming for students in one of the largest university systems in the country. Until now, freshmen entering California State University had to take placement exams in math and English. Students who didn't pass had to take remedial classes for no credit before they could sign up for regular college courses. But that was making for a long time without credit. Starting next year, the Cal State system is doing away with placement exams and remedial courses, part of an effort to boost their four-year graduation rate, which is at just 19%. Let's find out more from Dr. James Miner. He's the senior strategist for academic success and inclusive excellence for the Cal State system. Dr. Miner, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Robin.
You know, on the first blush, it's a little counterintuitive because we know this is determining if kids aren't ready for college and then helping them have a successful time at college. So start with what was wrong with the system.
Well, two things primarily. I think there is a growing body of evidence that suggests that the tools and protocols and assessment exams that we use to determine college readiness among incoming students are not the most valid assessments of how well they're likely to perform in college classrooms. Mm-hmm. And I think what we want to move to is a more full, rich assessment of college readiness, less reliance on standardized placement exams, and a greater incorporation of high school grades, GPA, and high school course taking. So that's number one. The second thing is that I think we have also a growing body of evidence that suggests that our treatment of students who are deemed underprepared academically, that relegating them to a non-credit-bearing course as a prerequisite, A, sends the wrong message. B, many of them are no better off in the next course than they would have been by simply just placing them there.
Well, but the fact is going to remain that these kids are still going to be needing some help and going into the classes. In the past few years, almost 40% of students coming into the Cal State system had to take these remedial classes. They didn't have any credits, but they had to pay for them. And it sort of set them aside. I guess the thinking was right from the starting gate, they are disadvantaged.
I think you're absolutely right in that students will arrive in need of additional academic support. The big change here with this policy is a fundamental shift in how we serve them when they arrive. So rather than relegating them to courses that don't earn them college credit, is to move them immediately into college courses and attach the additional academic support that they need to that course. So some campuses will incorporate co-requisite models. Some will go to academic support modules. Some will use supplemental instruction in very creative and innovative ways. And the decision making will be left to campus leaders and campus faculty to decide which one of those approaches works best for their students.
Well, you're getting pushback about changing from the system the way it exists now. Ronald Coleman, a professor of biological sciences at Sacramento State, which is one of the Cal State campuses, says many of his students are completely unprepared for college-level work. He's concerned. He says, I feel sorry for the students. The diagnostic tests serve as a reality check for them. That's going to be missing. The remedial courses provide the resources to get up to speed. He's concerned that this talk of embedding remedial work just isn't going to work, and these kids are going to fail, and they're going to be set up to fail because they haven't been helped.
Well, I'm not entirely surprised that some would have questions about this policy development, but I don't agree with the argument that this somehow is going to put students in a worse predicament. I have not spoken with anybody in the CSU community who could rightfully defend our current program and treatment of students who arrive in need of additional academic support. I think it's pretty clear that the programs that we have in place now underserve our students.
Overall, what's going on here? Why are so many young people unprepared to go to college, who get accepted to college? And why aren't they graduating?
There are a number of reasons. College affordability is a big challenge for CSU students, but students across the country. The other is that some of these students are balancing being a student, working full-time, raising children, contributing to their family. Most of us have an image in mind where a family would drive to a campus in a station wagon and out jumps an 18-year-old who is a recent high school graduate. That is really not today's average college student. Many of them are older than 20 years old. Many of them work more than 20 or 30 hours a week. And a lot of students are trying to fit college into their lives. And so, again, I think the challenge is really to be able to find creative and innovative ways to serve students' needs based on who they are and how they arrive.
That's Dr. James Miner, Senior Strategist for Academic Success and Inclusive Excellence for the Cal State System. Dr. Miner, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.